Hello, everyone. This is Noah France, one of your co-hosts from Cinema Joes, and welcome to a very special edition of our podcast today. And I can imagine some of you are thinking, what? Why is Noah hosting? Where's Justin? Well, Justin is here. Say hi, Justin.
Hello.
But he is not hosting because this is a special edition because a while back, Justin came to myself and a few other friends of ours, including our good friend Aaron, who is here with us today as well. Say hello, Aaron.
Ahoy, everybody.
Returning guest.
Yes, exactly. He is here in lieu of Alex, who is not able to join us today. But anyway, Justin gave a while back, Justin gave a few of us the task of assigning him a TV show, any sort of TV show. It could be new, old, animated, live action, series, drama, comedy, whatever. To give him a to-do list of TV shows that he had not yet seen that he should see. And Aaron gave Justin the assignment to watch one of the all-time most famous and most hotly debated anime classics, Hideaki Anno's Neon Genesis Evangelion. Now, at the time that Aaron gave him that assignment, I myself had just started watching Neon Genesis Evangelion. I'd also not seen it before, but it was made available a couple of years ago on Netflix, and I finally decided to take the plunge. And as soon as I finished it, and at that time, I knew that Justin was, at some point, was going to be watching it. I wrote to Aaron, and I wrote to Justin, and I said, as soon as you guys are ready, we're doing a special episode on this show. I have to talk about this show with you guys. So that's why we're here. We're here to do a special in-depth dive on our thoughts, opinions, and reflections on a very much a seminal classic and heavily influential anime that is still being discovered by people today. It's still being debated and discussed. Is it good? Is it bad? Do its flaws and its possible sins outweigh the good stuff? We're going to get into all that today. And we're going to start right off at the beginning with a massive spoiler warning. We are going, I very much intend for us to get into the nitty gritty about this show. So if you are listening to this and you've not seen the show yet and you do not want to be spoiled, turn away now. It's on Netflix. Go watch it. Anyway, so to give a brief sum up of the show itself, the show was was largely the brainchild of Hideaki Anno, a Japanese animator and director who, in part, got his start doing some early work for Hayao Miyazaki. He animated a lot of the key climax sequences in Nausicaä Valley of the Wind, which was the movie by Miyazaki that led directly to the founding of Studio Ghibli. And Miyazaki continued to be a huge supporter and a huge advocate for Anno and for his skills as an animator and a director after that. And after leaving the studio, or I don't know if he actually ever joined Studio Ghibli, but Anno took part in the formation of the film of the company Gainax and was involved in a couple of anime projects in the late 80s and early 90s, including another anime that's considered a classic and is very much considered a forerunner to Neon Genesis Evangelion, a series called Gunbuster, which Aaron and I have spoken about and we both really love. But Neon Genesis Evangelion is absolutely considered his magnum opus, so to say. It was produced in the 90s and released between 1995 and 1996, and it belongs to the genre of mecha anime. That is to say, there is some sort of extraterrestrial threat to Earth and to the human race. And at the beginning, it's not entirely clear what, but there are these powerful beings coming from space that seem intent on destroying the human race. And humanity has decided to respond by creating these giant mecha suits that are piloted, it seems, primarily by teenagers. And these mecha suits and these, basically these child soldiers, there's really no other way to spin it. They are given the task of piloting these giant suits and defending the Earth. That's the initial premise of the show. But as we will get into, Neon Genesis Evangelion goes quite a bit further than a lot of other mecha animes do, which are usually content to stay in the, this is an action show about fights between giant robots and giant space aliens. And the Pacific Rims of the world will usually leave it at that. Neon Genesis Evangelion eventually goes in quite a different direction, which is part of the reason why it has remained such a rich font of discussion and debate to this day. So that's the basic premise of the show, and this is now the last warning. We are not going to hold back on spoiling things after this. So I would like to hear, I'd like to start with you, Justin, because Aaron had seen the show before. It's been a while since I've watched it, so you were, relatively speaking, the newcomer. I'd like to get our general thoughts first before moving into some specific topics that I picked out today. So, Justin, what were some of your initial thoughts to the experience that is Evangelion?
Well, it's a lot. it's a whole lot. It's
cap
very
the
big
tweet,
emotions.
Cap, send tweet.
It's very deep themes. It deals heavily with psychological trauma. And it's not the kind of thing that if you're looking for like something to watch, like you need a little bit of an escape, this is not the anime that you want to watch. This is a heavy show. That's not to say that it doesn't have its more lighthearted moments. But this is a show that's very serious and
Justin, the way you phrased that reminded me of the time you wrote to me and said, yeah, last night I wanted to something to relax and make me laugh, so I turned on Danette and I was like, ooh.
Yeah, that was an ill-advised choice, to say the least. You know, even though it's very, even though I love it so much. But anyway, but I really liked this show a lot. I'm really glad that I saw it. I had heard about it. I didn't know a lot going in, apart from that it was a mecha anime and that it was apparently like one of the formative anime television series probably ever. Hugely influential. You know, it's interesting to me, especially reading more about it, that this was considered, you know, this has become so influential on anime and on other media as well. You know, other media in terms of, you know, animation, live action. But it was also kind of a subversion of the mecha anime genre at the time, which I find really fascinating. And watching it, like it definitely feels very fresh. It feels like it's almost a critique of other mecha animes that would come later, which is definitely, it says, I think, a lot about it. But yeah, like I'm really glad I saw it. It's a little bit difficult to follow, especially on a first watch, at least for me. It's very dense with plot, and you really have to be paying attention. There's a lot of dialogue explaining what's happening, but even if you're able to understand what's literally happening, it might take you a while to kind of grasp the psychological implications of what's happening. And that makes it, that's one of the reasons why I would say it's a show that probably merits rewatches. I apologize in advance if, as we're discussing this, I botched some of the plot details or some of the names.
I've got the Wikipedia page open, so I can refer to names.
Same.
I can refer to names and places. Yeah,
but yeah,
I'm also not the best at like spot remembering names.
But I'm really grateful that I saw it. I'm glad that I was able to watch it in bits with Aaron virtually. That really helped me sort of digest the context and be able to kind of focus on it. I don't think this is a show I'd recommend binge watching, even though it's a relatively short run. But yeah, it's a lot. It's a it's something that you really have to kind of I would recommend, like, you should probably steel yourself when you watch this. This is something that you know, I would not recommend just throwing on. But I'm definitely grateful that I saw it. I think there's a lot to get into. And, you know, just of the shows that I had my friends recommend, there was not a dud in the bunch. All of them were very good. So I thank both of you for that.
Well, of course, Justin, you have friends with good taste.
Yes, and that's the most important thing. Good taste.
Mm-hmm. All right. So there we go. So, Aaron, tell us a little bit about when you were first exposed to Neon Genesis Evangelion. My backstory is very simple. I'd also been hearing about it for years, but until it was released on Netflix, I just hadn't taken the time. But
yeah.
Aaron, when was your first exposure?
Well, that's my exposure to Evangelion. It's funny. It's a very fun one. So I first saw bits and pieces of this when it was running on, I believe, the Funimation channel. In, let's call it 2006, 2007, So there was a period when there was, I think it was Funimation had an anime channel on the television. And during that time, I would stay up late. I also saw Bakano this way, but I saw a couple of episodes of Evangelion, whatever that is, like 13, 14 years ago. And I was like, all right, well, that's odd. And then it was always kind of in the back of my mind. It's like, what was that really odd show with like the really vivid imagery that I saw when I was clearly too young? It was the summer of 2019. I had just graduated from law school. There was some other stuff going on. There was the bar to prepare for, and I was in a very not happy place. And that's when I saw Evangelion. I was like, oh, wait, this is that show from the way back when.
The way back machine.
From the way back machine. I remember these images. And so I saw it all the way through over the course of a week while I was preparing for the bar. And I adored it. I loved it. Like, oh, now I get why I was too young back then to see it. and I had been wanting to see it again. And so I was happy that Justin invited me to watch it with him. I had recommended it to him because it left such an impression on me. And I watched it with him. And it's funny because even after I saw it that, you know, all the way through in 2019, I wound up seeing it again, or at least most of it in 2020. And then I saw it all the way through with Justin earlier. Well, in the spring. So it's a delight. I really can't recommend it highly enough. And to me, it came at a really great time in my life. Seeing it all the way through, having the sort of emotional maturity to know what it was getting at. I actually think not only is it one of the best shows ever made, it's one of the actually essential shows. I think everyone should actually watch it. It's just
interesting.
That mature. I think it's really good.
I mean, I know a lot of people who would not be able to stand the show. There's lots of things that I think everyone should see, but I know that a lot of people would just not like them.
No, for sure. And it's not everyone's, it's obviously not everyone's cup of tea, but I feel like it's one of the few pieces of media that I encountered that actually takes seriously the sort of journey you have to go through in order to do self-care, right? Because self-care isn't just, oh, let me meditate sometimes. It's a whole approach to life. And I'm sure this is going to be a spoiler discussion at some point, but I think the upshot of the show is pretty clear of how important mental health is, not just for the individual, but for, well, the world.
Yeah, no, that's, I mean, Justin, you pointed out, it almost feels like, even though the show was a forerunner in a lot of ways, and mecha anime was still kind of like forming at the time this was made, and there's been tons of mecha anime, and mecha style stories have expanded into the mainstream with movies like Guillermo del Toro's Pacific Rim. So this was very much early stage mecha anime, but it still almost feels like it's predicting and commenting on some of the tropes that have since come up and sort of defined mecha anime. And a lot of those are tropes that I think people would use to dismiss mecha anime as if it's not something that immediately appeals to them. And I think a lot of this is captured by, and I'll send it to you guys later. So any of you out there who don't know about Film Crit Hulk, he's a guy on Twitter and he started doing YouTube videos who does really good, like deep analysis on film and media. And something he wrote in his analysis of this show that really stuck with me and that I don't think I could formulate any better than he does is at its core, mecha animes or mecha stories are about empowerment. It's about taking like the human form and beefing it up into the super metal giant with gun arms and giant swords and powers. And wow, yeah, okay, the human body is actually kind of frail, but you stick it in this metal suit and wow, we can fight giant monsters with it. But Neon Genesis Evangelion is about the limitations of power. It specifically puts very hard limits on the suits themselves and what they're actually capable of, and it puts incredible limits on the human beings that pilot them. So there's a level of desperation to a lot of the combat here that is almost a deconstruction itself of the kind of power fantasy that, at least theoretically, most mecha anime or mecha type stories are trying to serve.
And I think what's interesting about that sort of analogy, right, that a mech that – or not a mech, but that analysis from film critic Hulk, that mecha anime are story of empowerment, right? Because you get in the suit and you're empowered. Evangelion actually does sort of a empowermentception, right? Because – and you'll see this if any of you watch Shin Godzilla, also by Hideaki Anno.
Yeah, that's where, one of his most recent films. Yeah.
Yes. Where it's actually the society itself allows in Shin Godzilla, the society itself allows the defeat of Godzilla. And that's similar to Neon Genesis Evangelion is like, yes, the person goes into the robot and that's supposed to be empowering. But a person also exists in a society. Right. And a lot of time in Neon Genesis Evangelion is spent on looking at, well, what's the structure of the organization that they work for? NERV is what it's called, like NERV, NERV. And you think, right, it's empowering, right? Because I'm a small little person, but when I'm in this robot, I'm more powerful. Well, this robot's got limitations.
And I'm doing it to save the human race. Like I'm supposed to be a big hero. Like,
yeah, I'm doing it to be a big hero. This organization is supposed to save the human race. And then what makes the show really just phenomenal is not only does it tear that apart, the organization NERV, this is deep cut spoiler, is not there to save humanity.
No.
If anything, it's there to end it as we know it. It's just to stop the, you know, eldritch horror angels from destroying humanity in their own way. It's we need to destroy humanity in our way to achieve our. So it's a deeply skeptical show about society. It's a deeply skeptical show about institutions, but it's still about, you know, happiness, right? It's a show fundamentally about happiness, and that's what makes it really powerful, especially when you get into the films, is you see how close these few good, you know, these good people, because there are good people in the show, right? It's, you know, we don't want to give you the sense that this is everyone is trying to backstab each other horribly. It's actually people trying their best to help each other. They just, for the most part, don't have the emotional intelligence to do that. And once they develop that emotional intelligence, it's too late to actually change the outcome, which makes it a really powerful statement.
So we're talking about, you know, so there are these organizations that apparently, so one of the setups of the show is that these eldritch horrors, these Lovecraftian monsters, and they're really like the designs and powers and differences between these creatures are really amazing. Like this is not, these are not your stock paper, you know, cutout Godzilla wannabes. Like these are really fascinating creations. They are called angels. And they are called angels. And then you have the organization NERV kind of representing the body in theory. And then there's a parent organization called Seele, which is the German word for soul. And then on top, so you have these literally these angels in air quotes coming to destroy the planet. And they're given code names based on biblical angels and biblical figures. And there's a weapon called the Spear of Longinus, which is a reference to the centurion Longinus, who is said to have stabbed Jesus when he was dying on the cross. And you have crosses galore. So there's tons of Christian terms and theology and imagery laced throughout the show. Now, a lot of people have argued that that's all a red herring, and that's all there's supposedly a quote from Honoré said, "Oh, I just wanted it to look cool," and the word angel sounded cool, and that's why. And you know, I thought Genesis using a title based around the first book of the Bible, it just sounded cool. I don't know if I buy that, but I'd like to hear your guys' thoughts. Do you think that religion is actually an integral part and the idea of faith is an integral part of this show and what it's trying to get at, or is this more of like a socio-political commentary?
I think Justin should go first on that one. I have my own thoughts, but I feel like I've taken the floor for a bit.
Oof, that's a big question. It seems so deliberate to me that the fact that it would just be there for show seems suspect at best to me. The fact that we do get these like giant crosses in the sky every time an angel is destroyed, like that seems very purposeful.
It's big. It's a big cross.
You can't miss it. Which
it's a literal cross of light.
Right.
I think like and one of the things, you know, as someone who is not particularly religious, I think we sort of take for granted this the idea of Christianity, this symbol of the cross, right? It's just like, oh, that represents Christianity. But it's this, you know, it is a symbol of what Jesus died on. It's a symbol of sacrifice. And I think it's really fascinating. And especially in the early stages of the show, when you don't know, like you think maybe, okay, these angels, like I'm not quite sure about Nerve, but these angels seem like, you know, somebody's got to do something about them, right? Like they seem pretty bad news. The fact that like every time they're destroyed, you get this giant cross, I think is, you know, purposeful foreshadowing about the about the intentions of the angels and about the more devious motives of Nerve. And especially the last angel who is destroyed, who I think is an ultimate representation of sacrifice, but is also an integral part of Shinji, our main character, his growth and his coming to terms and his, you know, I guess you could say coming to a certain kind of peace by the end of this. So if it is being, if the iconography is being used for show, it seems coincidental to me that it also corresponds with these themes of sacrifice that are woven throughout the show. You know, I think there's a lot of, you know, you've got the picture, the symbol who looks like he's on the cross. Like it seems purposeful, not just in terms of being deliberate with the iconography itself, but to the themes of the show. So even if it's not necessarily a religious allegory per se, it seems to me that all that iconography is being used very deliberately as part of what the show is going for and as part of the growth and ultimate realizations, revelations, you could even say, of the characters. And I think he's mixing a lot here, but in a way that feels very deliberate and feels like, even if you're not especially a religious person, that you might be able to recognize or have some inkling of what these symbols might mean to people who are religious. And I think that's really clever. And I like the fact that it's kind of a stew. It's not yeah, just limited to traditional thinkings about Judeo-Christian symbolism. There's, you know, he's in some cases like really taking that and almost blaspheming it. And I find that really fascinating. But also I think that speaks to how this is a very personal show. It's not meant to just be a representation of a particular religious idea. It is very much its own thing, drawing upon a history and a tradition that might be very familiar to a lot of people, maybe particularly Western audiences, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Right. It's interesting to sort of tie these different threads together in here. You know, Noah mentioned, you know, Genesis, right? It's the first book of the Bible. But Neon Genesis Evangelion, right? So Evangelion comes from evangelist, right? Which is to spread the good word. So the show's translation of the title is spreading of the new good word, right?
Yeah.
That's literally what it means. And so, like Justin, I don't think the Christian imagery, Judeo-Christian imagery, I don't think that's incidental. This is not to say, you know, that it's Christianity is what's being pushed here, but it's, you know, this is a story about individuals, you know, trying to find happiness, right? Trying to find, you know, in a sense, redemption. And I it's hard for me to imagine a more stereotypical kind of base root Judeo-Christian story arc than one of redemption. And, you know, it's what's being redeemed. Well, you'll have to watch the show to figure out, because that's up to interpretation. It's up to interpretation.
No, it's...
So I mean, I fundamentally agree. I mean, this is a, you know, this is a show. Yes, it's a stew. It absolutely is a stew. But what makes it a great stew is how forthrightly, genuinely, honestly, it addresses each of the parts of the stew. Yes, part of it's a mental health, a big part's mental health, and it engages with that honestly. Like,
so let's talk about that a bit, because these are this whole cast of characters. The main character is this teenage boy, Shinji Ikari, and most are everything is predominantly from his perspective. Mm-hmm. Although we do more and more over the course of the show get some of the perspective of Asuka and Rei, the two teenage girls who are his sort of comrades, and they're the other two mecha pilots. And then there are the adult figures, the adult figures around them, including Shinji Ikari's deadbeat dad, Genji, who worst dad ever in the history of anything. I'm going to plant my flag right there right now.
He's pretty bad.
As soon as he appears in the first episode, I was like, oh, this is your backstory, Shinji. I'm so sorry. So this is all of these people are fundamentally broken, very, very fundamentally broken. Even the adults.
especially the adults.
Yeah, no, especially, like, these are deeply traumatized, depressed people. What's her name? The woman who, Misato. The woman who's kind of like the mentor to Shinji and takes him in. She has a really horrific backstory. The main female scientist who's in charge of the mecha suits and of all the complex programs that run NERV's command center has a really torturous relationship with her own mother and also with Shinji's dad. So there are a lot of issues of trauma and of depression. And I mean, a lot of that comes from the creator himself. Ano famously admitted later on that he himself was in the midst of a massive depressive period of his life when he produced that show. And it shows, like, it is very much, this is one of those, I think this is one of those works where you can really see the creator of it kind of inserting a lot of himself into the characters at various points in time. And one of the ways in which this brokenness, especially in the part of Shinji, I think, and of the other child characters, one of the ways that this brokenness manifests itself, and it's one of the, I think one of the, simultaneously one of the most fascinating parts of the show, but also one of the hardest to discuss because it's one of the biggest criticisms of the show, is sexuality. Shinji is an incredibly horny teenage boy with no social skills, with no healthy relationships with anyone. And as we all know, that's a really shitty mix. And that is not conducive. That is not conducive to having healthy emotional relationships with anyone. So I think it is important for us to address that at some point, because there are certain things that happen at various points of the show that are kind of horrific and very violating in a way. And there is also a clear sexualization of the female characters, whether or not they're children or the adults. So, you know, Misato is this super attractive. And on the surface, she seems to be the super cool, high functioning, you know, supermodel, but also a super scientist, but who she can also like fight and almost feels like a fantasy fulfillment character until that in and of itself is revealed to just be a facade. But there is a lot of sexualization of the female characters. And that is. Like, one of the defenses of that is, oh, well, that's anime. Like, 80s and 90s anime is full of sexualized characters. And Ano himself is no stranger to this. I mentioned earlier one of his previous series before this was another mecha anime called Gunbusters, which I deliberately sought out and watched after I finished Evangelion. And Gunbusters is great. It's an amazing... It's only 6 episodes, but it's absolutely amazing. It is a powerhouse experience. But... there is also a lot of sexualization in there. And in Gunbusters, the sexualization like, there are a couple of scenes in every episode where it's like, okay, here come the boob shots. And they're only there to be there and for the purpose of being, like, titillation. Whereas the sexualization of the characters in Evangelion and the fact that much of it is incredibly uncomfortable, and even in one very notorious instance, like, a kind of assault, in a way, it's not, like, the show, it almost feels like the show is, in the case of Evangelion, it almost feels like Evangelion is aware of this and is consciously sitting with the fact that, yeah, these characters are really fucked up, and this has a very bad influence on their, like, how they interact with their sexuality and how their sexuality influences their interactions with other people. And you, the viewer, you're going to sit here with us and you're going to feel how awkward and uncomfortable this is. And we're not going to give you any easy answers. You're going to have to sift this out on your own. So while I do completely get people criticizing Evangelion for those aspects, and I completely get if someone says that that's something that turns them off the show completely, it seems to me that there's an intentionality or there's an intent behind the sexualization that goes beyond simply, oh, well, we got to, you know, we got to get these side boob shots to, you know, satisfy our 13-year-old otaku fans. So it was something I'd heard about before. Like, I had heard some of the criticisms of the show before I'd ever seen it. So I kind of had my eyes and ears open for that when I was watching the show. And that's what I ended up taking away from it upon my viewing. What do you guys think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the overt sexualization is purely intentional for pretty much all of it. I'd argue there's one scene in End of Evangelion, which is a shot of Misato walking away, and we're at
ass level.
Yeah, we're at ass level. Yeah. That's the only shot that I think is not justifiable. I mean, and consider they have one sex scene that we are aware of in this show. At least I'm aware of. There's one sex scene, and well, that, you don't see it.
Exactly. There's one where Misato and what's the guy's name?
Ryoji.
Ryoji.
Kaji's the last name, I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's like, and that's an example where like you would completely expect, you know, the fan service, you know, side boob shots. But instead, that entire scene, or I guess it's post-sex.
It's during sex, right? Because she's moaning, and like her hand, or it's like, it might not even be her hand. It might be like a shot of like a glass and cigarettes. That's what I recall.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking of. It's a shot of a brandy glass and like a smoking cigarette. And we're hearing the dialogue, but you're not getting, you know, these shots of entwined naked bodies.
No.
So that's one of the reasons why I came away thinking, okay, there was a reason why they did the sex stuff, like when it was explicit, there's a reason why they did it. And it wasn't just to, you know, give teenage boys a hard on.
Yeah, I think it's very, so to me, I you know, everyone has different sensibilities. The overt sexualization, I don't think ever really bothered me. You know, it's intentional, one, because of that sex scene, and the other, assault, right? I mean, it's an assault that happens in End of Evangelion.
Yeah, so
neither of which are played for any kind of titillation.
The scene in the hospital with Asuka unconscious and Shinji literally jerking off, like, that is, it's a horror scene.
You also don't see it, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, and it's framed. It feels like it's being framed as a horror scene. I don't feel. I never got the sense that, okay, Anno's trying to like excuse this in some way.
Right.
And that scene is actually the catalyst for Shinji spending most of that movie, just wrapped up in his own guilt and shame, and kind of helping to cause a lot of unnecessary death to his friends and comrades as a result of that.
Oh yeah. No, and this is why I think the show is so great. The whole arc, you know, from the first episode to the end of Evangelion, it's great because Shinji keeps making they're not bad decisions at the time until you see him at the very end. You're like, oh my God, why are you assaulting this woman? But you could see every step that led to it, right? And every step is he didn't know how to take care of himself. And I think Masato's actually key to understanding the themes of the show, because she eventually realizes, oh God, someone has to address the mental needs of these kids. And I'm going to do the best I can, but I'm kind of a mess. But at least I'm going to try.
Yeah, Masato probably takes the most steps in that direction.
Very and she tries to help steps. Shinji out, and Asuka, yeah. and Rei. She tries, and that's what she's my favorite character, because she always tries to help them. But no, Shinji, you know, yes, he is, if he got in the gosh darn robot in End of Evangelion, it would have been a completely different outcome. But
well, theoretically, we don't know that. I mean, it might have.
I guess we don't.
You could argue that you could interpret that you could interpret a certain level of inevitability into a lot of what happens.
You could, but I think with because they set this up and this is deep cut, hasn't really been addressed before, might get addressed later on in this podcast. But the Shinji's robot's real special. In large part because of Shinji's relationship with his robot. We'll let that stew for you for a hot second. I think he had a real shot of changing the trajectory, but he had to be in a mental place to do that, and he wasn't. And so we got, you know, what happens in End of Evangelion.
Yeah.
To address your question, Noah, I feel like I'm not quite convinced that the show completely gets away with it. Like, I think that it is leaning into some of that over-sexualization, especially of the women. I say that considering that I don't think there's the same level of, shall we say, leering that is given to the male form as there is to the female form in this. So I'm not convinced that it's like gets off scot-free necessarily. I will say
I would not argue that either. But it almost feels like the show knows that. You know what I'm saying?
It's possible. I think it can also, you know, I think the other reading could be like, well, it's kind of using that as a justification for and this is not something that's new to anime. Okay. It was new to anime at the time or has gone away necessarily, considering the level of, you know, that especially at this point, it was a lot of male creators in that industry. But I do think it is. I do think it's doing more than that. And I think it's fascinating that the way that sex is depicted in this, you know, it's really in some ways not depicted, I guess. We don't see a lot of it, but certainly what is implied is a lot of that, when it happens, it's never really like in a good environment. Like, it's not relationships that are really conducive or healthy.
Yeah, no, no, no,
you know. No. And I think that that does affect, you know, certainly I think that affects a lot of the, you know, Shinji particularly, given how he basically has become emotionally stunted. And I do think there's a level for someone like him who has not had a lot of exposure to this to, you know, sort of experience it through his eyes to a certain extent. You know, I think it's realistic about the fact that a boy of his age would be, you know, let's say appreciative of
it's a lot of very normal teenage hormones form. It's right. A lot of very normal teenage hormones, but odd, but very clearly twisted by his very 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 traumatizing circumstances.
Yeah, and I think his relationship with Asuka I think is really fascinating, and I think that's a case where both of them I think are kind of, you know, they're very similar in some ways, but because of that similarity, it's like they can never really make that connection. I think that's really fascinating. I think the way that they sort of approach each other, always a little bit guarded, always a little bit like, you know, always like very self-conscious. I mean, this is not a show where sexuality is really celebrated or really shown to be like a healthy, at least in these circumstances. I want to make that distinction. I don't think it's saying that sex is unhealthy. I'm saying within these circumstances of these characters, it's very difficult to try to find something. And I think it goes beyond sex, but like something meaningful, some real connection.
Mm.
I think it is interesting, like maybe the one scene that we do see the most of in terms of a sex scene is between Misato and Ryuji, because that actually seems like maybe it didn't ever happen, but there was perhaps a chance of that to become a healthier relationship.
Ryuji certainly almost feels like he's the most mentally balanced person on screen.
Yeah,
at a certain level.
Yeah, there's.
And what does he get for that? He gets killed off screen.
Right.
You don't even get to see him die.
Misato is becomes a close second by the end, and then she dies. So.
Yeah. Well, and then it ends with her like promising Shinji sex, which is like, whoa, okay.
Actually, hold up. Let's take a moment and analyze that scene specifically, because it's pretty. I think it's pretty great.
All right. Okay.
It's specifically. Well, because I always interpreted that as a last ditch Hail Mary, right?
Yeah.
Like, right? to motivate Shinji.
Yeah, because she knows nothing else is helping. So it's like.
Right, she's also bleeding out.
She's shot. No,
we want to be clear. We are not advocating relationships between adults.
We are not. Fuck that shit.
Big disclaimer sign right now.
Big disclaimer. No, but it's clearly a last ditch effort to try to get him to get in the fucking robot. but she.
The eternal meme.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I did not understand that meme until end of Evangelion. And then it's like, literally, I will do whatever it takes, Shinji, to get you in that robot. I swear to God, Shinji, I will go into such. Do you want to go to Hollywood, Shinji? I'll whatever you want, man. Whatever you want, I am going to get you. I am going. Whatever you just do it, right? And so that's where she's coming from with that, and it's great because she feels like shit afterwards too. And I think that's also clear. So if you're going to have a scene that clearly touches on a really, you know, dark subject matter, right? Like, you know, like some sort of sexual thing with a minor, unless you're going to go all the way and show how fucking horrible that is, this scene's probably about as good as you can do.
Okay, that's an interesting. I think that's an interesting way to see it. So I want to, I want to touch on a couple moments in the show that are iconic and or notorious. So the show, in addition to a lot of the heavy thematic stuff, the show was kind of legendary for having a bit of a troubled production. There were rumors that it kept getting budget cuts. I don't know. I've seen people argue that that was actually not true. But it is true that as Anno sunk further and further into depression and also started to go in very wild directions with the story. Like at one point, Justin mentioned to me, oh, yeah, I'm on episode 8 right now. And I was like, oh, you're in the normal part of the show. we're about to dive into the deep end here. So there are a couple of moments that the show is rather notorious for that are considered either signs that they were having production and or budget issues, or they're criticized as Anno was way too deep in his own ass and was trying to be artistic and pretentious, and it made the show worse. So the moments that I'd like to see if you guys have any thoughts on them. There's a scene where Asuka gets into an elevator with Rei, and they stand in silence, in bitter, bitter silence for almost a minute. And for animation, that's a long time. That's a long time to hold on something, especially if you're like in a 23-minute animated show. that's a lot of time and effort to watch people to like animate people standing in an elevator. And they are animated because like the characters like sneeze or like move their shoulders. It's not like you're not watching a still image. So there's that moment. There's the other moment where Shinji is actually in the robot and he's deciding whether or not he's going to kill Kaworu, who is supposed to be a human that Shinji actually starts to befriend and maybe falls in love with. Hashtag queer representation. But he turns out to be another angel. And Shinji is trying to decide whether or not to kill him. And he has him gripped in the hand of his mecha suit again for a minute, 2 minutes, while a section from crap. Is it Handel's Messiah? I'm blanking.
It's is it Joy to the World?
No, it's not Joy to the World. It is not Joy to the World. It's so I'm gonna kick myself later. I think it's a piece from Handel's Messiah, and it's just a still shot of the mecha robot. It's not even Shinji's face. You're just seeing the mecha robot holding a diminutive figure in its fist before Shinji like squeezes and pops his head off like a wine bottle cork. And then the third moment, a moment that quite frankly melted my brain when I first experienced it, is during one of the battles with the angels where
it's
it
the
launches
to Joy. Sorry.
No, it's not. It's the Alleluia chorus, not the Ode to Joy. It's the Alleluia chorus from Handel's Messiah plays while one of the angels launches a psychic attack against Asuka.
Oh, this one.
And basically knocks her and like before she falls unconscious, she spends like you're hearing the Hallelujah chorus, one of the purest, most joyous pieces of music ever created by the human race. And while you're hearing this music, a little girl is screaming about her brain, about how her brain is being raped by the angel. Like that is literally what the line is that she's screaming. I'd like to know, what do you guys think of these moments? Because these are some of the most notorious moments in the entire show. Is this artistic pretension? Was Anno up his own ass? Are these like the still shots budget cuts? Like what were your takeaways from those moments?
I don't think it's again. I think it's a bit of both. I would say. at the same time,
we have
I think
to
you
solve
can...
this now, Justin. There can never
right
be debate
now.
Ever again.
So I don't remember. I mean, maybe I should have done it. It looks like certainly Kaworu is humming the Ode to Joy. I don't remember if it's in that last scene where he's killed.
Hear the orchestral music, like you hear the whole chorus singing.
Okay.
It's not in universe. Like you're hearing, hearing an orchestral recording of the chorus.
But to your question, yeah, I think it's a bit of both. At the same time, I think the show was leveraging some of that limitation to its advantage. I love the scene on the elevator because, and I think this is part of the, like, it's so against the rhythm of the show, but that's part of like what makes it stand out. For a show that is a lot of heavy exposition about what Nerve is doing and what the Evangelions are doing, to have that moment, I think it also just kind of amplifies that moment because in real life, if that were to happen, you can feel the time passing. You can feel you feel that pause.
We've all been there. We've all been in an elevator with someone we don't want to be near. That's pretty
universal. It's also them kind of like unwilling to acknowledge certain aspect, like certain things that they may be wrong about, certain grudging respect they might have for one another. So there's a lot going on in that scene, and it gives you the space to kind of wrestle with that.
There was any of you watching this who are not aware, there's a YouTuber I'm a big fan of called Super Eye Patch Wolf. He did a great video. Yeah, and Aaron, I know you know him. He did a great video specifically on this scene. And he points out in the video, and I'd actually forgotten this until he pointed it out, that elevator scene takes place in the midst of an episode or a couple of episodes that has basically shown us the process of Asuka as a character being broken apart. Like she started off as the super confident, I can do and be anything hotshot, to a point where she is completely falling apart and is even failing at being an Ava pilot. and which is, was basically her identity at that point. And we're in the process of learning why. I think the image that reveals to us like one of the central experiences of her character is one of those brilliant moments in the show. But like, that's the background going into that scene in the elevator. We're watching this character who's supposed to be this super good hotshot basically fall to pieces. And now she's forced to stand in an elevator with a character that in her eyes is her biggest competition and is like, in air quotes, the reason that she's failing, because stupid Ray is like playing mind games with her or something. Or Ray is, everyone likes Ray, but they don't like me, and they pay attention to Ray and they ignore me. And that made me appreciate the scene a whole lot more when I saw someone really break down the context of it like that.
Oh yeah, I'm inclined to think that I think that there's a clear delineation in my mind between, you know, what, which is budget cuts, which is artistic integrity, and which is the artist just being up his own butt. The elevator scene is great. I it really does make you uncomfortable, which is nice. This is a show that's about giving you the it's about being uncomfortable. Right. And so maybe there's some budgetary or some planning issue there, but it worked artistically, so it gets a pass. I think it's great. The Asuka getting mind raped while Handel's Messiah's Hallelujah Chorus is going on, that's just great. So Handel's Messiah, right, the Hallelujah Chorus, where it takes place in the Messiah, right, where it's located, is right, it's the second coming of Jesus, right? Yeah. That's what that song is about. So it's an oddly fitting track for
which
something so horrible.
Hold on, which angel is it that is?
It's the 11th, I think. It's episode like 22, because then you have episode 23 is the 12th angel, which kills Rey, and then episode 24 is, oh, Kaoru's his own subject, I think, but so I won't touch on Kaoru. So I think there's actually real artistic integrity for the Handel's Messiah use for that particular scene. I think it's actually expertly done. The Ode to Joy with the still image of Shinji crushing Kaoru, that is a mixture, I think, of budgetary concerns and just Hideaki Anno trying too hard to be profound. That's my gut reaction to it. And I like that scene, but I have my own theory about Kaoru. Everyone, I think, has a theory about what Kaoru actually is.
Let's talk about Kaoru then.
Yeah, I mean, so watching the show with Justin was great, because Justin, at least, I don't know whether he still sticks with the interpretation, but clued me into a certain collective unconscious property that the angels might have. So I took it and ran with that. So I actually think that Kaoru is an angel specifically intended to defeat Shinji. And he's intended to defeat Shinji because he has two types of love for Shinji in him. Rei's love of Shinji, which is more of a fraternal kind of love. And three types of love. Asuka's sort of repressed romantic love for Shinji. And big spoiler here, Shinji's mom's love of Shinji. So I think he embodies three different types of love for Shinji.
Interesting.
Which is why he fails, but it also explains why it's so difficult for Shinji to do something with him.
Why he fails because Shinji's not capable of, like...
He fails because he loves Shinji, right? The angels created this perfect weapon to destroy humanity because it can defeat everything, including Shinji, because it understands Shinji as only a mother, a friend, and a lover could. It has all three at once, right? So you have Ritsuko talking about a woman is three things, a woman, a mother, and her profession, right? That's all. We can talk about the sexism of that statement later.
Okay, yeah, but, that's, but, yeah.
But what it captures is the idea that people can be multiple things at once.
And
they have to wear different hats. But so Kaoru is all three hats of understanding someone. And he is the only one who understands Shinji. He's the only one who loves Shinji. And that's why he fails to destroy the world. But Shinji, with the robot grabbing Kaoru, it felt a little bit like Game of Thrones season 8, episode 5 or 6, uh-oh, remember? Right. Uh-oh. When Daenerys starts burning down King's Landing, and you're like, I could see why that happened, but I wanted to see Emilia Clarke's face during it, and you don't see her face when she's burning down the city because no one knew what her face was when she was doing it. And I felt there was a much more powerful scene to be had if we were to sit with Shinji. The scene would be better if it was just looking at Shinji in the cockpit. Just if it was him in the cockpit and we see his hand on the, even if it's his hand on the controller, right? And we don't, and maybe we get that iconic image for a second and the rest of it is looking at Shinji's hand on a controller. I'd be like, that's what the scene should be. It should be looking at the decision, like what's the thought process Shinji had before he killed his mom, his best friend, and his lover. That's the moment. And
it's kind of,
it feels sort of cheap with
as it, with I feel like as it drags on, it becomes more clear, like, okay, obviously Shinji's gonna kill him. Like I think as that shot draws on, it kind of, I think you can feel the suspense kind of drain away a bit. Maybe at first you're like, okay, maybe he'll let him go, but eventually like, nah, he's gonna kill him.
Right. And I think
cut the chase, guys.
I think he's going to kill him, but there's a way to make that even release of tension that he's gonna kill him more impactful.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think if they had focused on Shinji on that moment, that would have been the stronger artistic choice.
That is a fascinating interpretation of Kaoru.
I
like that idea.
Yeah, I was just so disarmed by him, and I'm sure that was the idea. I was really and I think that last scene, I don't know if I necessarily needed to see his, I feel like the way that's, I feel like that last shot is, everything has kind of been built up to that. So I don't know if I necessarily needed to see like a close up or like a real, I don't know if I needed like a focus on him, because I think that shot is meant to not just imply what Shinji's going through, but like the fate of the world and the fact that he's been brought to this point. And I think I like the shot itself. I do agree. I think it goes on way too long. I think holding on it for a bit is fine. The way it does hold on, I agree with you, Noah. I think you're kind of like, oh, okay, I know what's going to happen now. It kind of lets all the suspense out. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think the way that the angels seem to adapt, and the fact that the last form is one that's not, is one that's recognizable, that's, taking, sort of in the image of the creation, so to speak, doesn't seem like an accident to me. So whatever is controlling the angels,
it's like it comes around full circle. You start with these giant typical monsters, like very much what you'd expect. And then you circle back down to a human.
Yeah.
A human form.
Yeah.
So, okay, so Kaoru's death is what sets up, and then like the crisis that sparks within Shinji. That's what leads us to the ending. Now we've got two different endings here. There was the show where the last two episodes go deep. They just go straight deep into the heart of this psychology of these characters, and we're seeing basically montages of images and sequences, some of which are animated normally, some of which seem to be like sketch or concept art, and some of which are just like stick figures, like moving around on like a blank sheet of paper. It gets really abstract. It gets really vague. And it drops everything with the angels and with Nerve and with Zayla and with like all of this big theological philosophical what the fuckery world building that had really been building up to that point. The last two episodes of the show just drop that, and we just do a deep dive into Shinji's brain, basically. And we have this famous sequence where he seems to come to some sort of epiphany and kind of arrives in like a theater setting where he's surrounded by the other characters and everyone's together again and happy. That came out and ended the show. People hated it. Anno got attacked for it. He got criticized for it. He got death threats. So they went back and made the end of Evangelion, which goes the exact opposite track. It takes this incredible production and detailed world building and images and takes it to such an extreme, and it basically depicts Nerve and Zayla basically going after, like, once the angels are gone, Nerve and Zayla basically turn on each other and just destroy each other. And we find out the whole goal of Zayla was basically to initiate the rapture, question mark. It feels like the rapture.
Mm-hmm.
And it leads to a whole series of just images of Rei's and Shinji's, like, it is literally indescribable. I cannot sum up, even any of you who's seen it, you know this. It's not possible to put this into words, but you're basically seeing the apocalypse. It's Armageddon. The world is being destroyed. Human beings are literally being turned, like they're being raptured and turned into orange goop, while these horrific images play out like on a literally galactic scale. Until at the very end, we just have Shinji and Asuka alone in this wrecked and ruined landscape with the corpses of the Eva suits scattered about. So we have two different endings that could not be more different. And ever since then, the debate has raged. Is one of the endings better or worse than the other? Are these two completely different endings, or are these the same ending being told two different ways? I want to start off with what my impression was. I love the ending of the show. I thought it was great. I thought it was amazing. I was much more conflicted and overwhelmed by the ending of the end of Evangelion. However, what I want to just get out there is, I must say, you know, we always talk about like the rapture or the end times or Armageddon or the apocalypse in our world, especially like in regards to its Christian or theological significance. Well, not just Christian, like all religions have some sort of end times concept. I feel like most of the time we always assume that there will be something there in some way. The rapture or the end of times, at least in the Christian sense, would be like pleasant. Like, oh, the good people float up to heaven and angels come and there's harps and nice music and the bad people just disappear and go away. I think the end of Evangelion is the closest that I have yet seen to depicting what the rapture or the apocalypse would actually look like. It would not be nice. It would not be pleasant. There would be no clear line between, oh, good things happen to good people and bad to bad people. No, it would be fucking terrifying. It would be what the end of Evangelion is, just beyond the scope of any human brain to comprehend. And it would be absolutely horrifying to witness and to experience. So that was my takeaway from the end of Evangelion. I don't know if you guys agree or disagree with that, but I walked away saying that's the best portrayal of the rapture that I think I've ever seen on the big screen.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. It is the end of the world. And I don't, any other way that you end the world, I feel like kind of pales in comparison to what
it's
going
to be disingenuous to try and pretend that it'll be nice for some people. Like, no, it's fucking awful. It's the end of the world.
Yeah, it's and I agree with you. My preference is for the show's ending, but that's, I think, because the show's ending addresses the themes of it, of the series, more directly. I think it gives all of the characters, right, because it's Shinji's therapy session is the last two episodes.
It's basically a therapy session, yeah.
It is, but how does he go through therapy? He goes through therapy by talking to the parts of other people left within him. So he has to come to peace with other people. So he has to come to peace with Asuka, he has to come to peace with Rei, he has to come to peace with Misato. So I think thematically I actually much prefer the show ending to the film. But I don't know if you can understand the ending of the show without the film. I think at least on some level you want to know what happens with all the plot stuff, even though I'd say on repeat viewings the plot really, I mean, it really doesn't matter that much.
That's what I love about the show's ending. Like the show feels like, and maybe this wasn't the case, maybe this was like budget or production issues coming into play, but the show's ending feels like it's saying, okay, all this deep world building that you've been obsessing over and that we've been building up, not important. We're throwing it out the window. It's gone. Now we're just going to deal with, like, how do you process trauma and become a psychologically whole person again? That's what we're going to do now.
It comes at the end of the world, right?
Right, which kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
Right? You know,
I love the way that, like, especially like as time has gone by, I was a little bit confounded by the last two episodes of the show. Like,
perfectly
wait,
reasonable.
What? Where
perfectly
are we?
Yeah.
And recognizing like when it takes place, and also just like the way you could interpret it, right? Like, is this just like a last thought before the end for Shinji? Like, is this, or is this like a new beginning? Is this the afterlife that we're in? Like, I love that the show doesn't really answer those questions. I do think, like, I think like the film does give you context. I don't know if it's just as time's gone by, I find it like less and less essential. But I think the fact that it does happen when it happens, and that it also feels like it's filtered through his perspective, is really key. I mean, I think you could look at that last, the last scene of all the people in his life applauding for him as, you know, like ridiculous. Like, what is going on? Like, this is the show I've been watching, but actually like it's coming after this whole reckoning and wrestling with depression and with the ultimate realization that yes, like other people are necessary and are part of what gets you through this. Like retreating into yourself does not ultimately do you any good, even if you feel like that's what you know the only thing you deserve. And that's like such a profound realization, because he has not always had the best people, the people with his best interests at heart in his life, and to still think that like this is the way, this is part of how I'm going to get through this, even if it's too late. That's just like that. I think that's really hopeful, and I think that shows a lot of faith in humanity, ultimately, which, you know, when the show has shown us maybe some not so good examples of it.
No, I think that's especially, and there's a couple of things about the final two episodes I think really are worth expanding on even there. One, I think, is, I guess you'd call it the fantasy sequence, when he's shown what the world could have been. If you recall it,
that doesn't make
you cry.
That hit me so
like,
fucking
every
hard.
Every time. Because I think for people who suffer from mental illness, and everyone, one really, but especially for people who suffer from some sort of mental illness, that scene hits like a Mack truck, because
we all have that image of what the perfect life could be, and you know, maybe we can still get there,
but you
know,
can. I think that's I think that's why the show is fundamentally hopeful, right? Is if you work on yourself, right? If you, it might not be Misato's literally the teacher of the school, your parent, you know, your mom's gone, Shinji, she's not coming back, your dad's a deadbeat, but the thing is, if you have a more positive mindset, if you have a healthier mindset, you will attract people who are likely more positive, likely have a more healthy mindset, and you can have something like that, right? So you can make the world you want for yourself. And so even though, yeah, Shinji's depressed and you empathize with him, the last two episodes, like, Shinji, it didn't have to be this way. It doesn't have to be this way. If you can learn to love yourself, you will be happier. You will be around people who will make you happier. You will make them happier. And that's, I think, the importance of other people. And when is the only time that I can recall that the theme music is played? You know, Zanu Koku no Tenshin, right? It's played at the beginning, and it's a banger of an opening. But it's the only other time it's played. Last episode, right when Shinji is coming to the realization, wait, I can be the young man who seizes the world. I can be the young man who can be happy. That's when that song plays. And I think as sort of, it's really just a beautiful ending. Obviously, you can see why people hate it because, you know, you had to, it's like you had to know going in that the plot didn't really matter. And you were really just supposed to be following like Shinji's, you know, like mental health state and just pay attention to everyone's mental health state. That's the thing you have to be paying attention to in the show. If you don't know going in, you hate the last episode.
But still, the people who dogpiled on Anno and on his crew for that, like,
guys,
like, those guys suck.
Well, and they sent death threats not just to Anno, but to the animators and to the other writers. It's like, I agree. It's really scummy behavior. It's just...
Yeah, it is. And it almost feels like he's throwing a few middle fingers into the final, like, the massive final mind-fucking sequence of the end of Evangelion, because that's like the end of Evangelion does not break the fourth wall. It nukes the fourth wall. It includes real world footage and shots in some cases of people like getting angry over the show. It has overlaid footage on a couple of times of I think people gathering for a screening of the end of Evangelion. Like, it goes super fucking meta.
It does.
But in my opinion, in just the best way.
Oh, yeah. Because,
like, it commits to it. It goes 195%.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. 100%. This is not a subtle show.
No.
Yeah.
But I love it for that. So, Justin, was this bizarre, strange, sometimes maybe dirty and uncomfortable journey worth it?
Yeah. I would say so. It's, again, not for the faint of heart. This is not something you're like, oh, it's an animated show. That's obviously, you know, so I can watch it just like I watch, say,
don't
Avatar
show
Last
it to
Airbender.
Your kids, you freaks. Don't.
Yeah, really don't. Really don't. This
Wait
is
till cool. they're 18.
yeah, and we didn't really talk about it, but I just wanted to say, like, unlike other, at least other mecha animes that I'm familiar with, this really wrestles with body horror in a way I was not expecting.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed that. I like that they don't spell it out really. Like you kind of realize it over time that there is this biological component to the mecha to the Evangelions as well as the mecha aspect. So I really
so
like that
fluids.
A lot.
Guys, there's so many fluids. In
yeah.
This
yeah.
Too many
you have
fluids.
Shinji in one episode. You have Shinji literally spending an episode as dissolved orange goop.
Yeah,
and
so,
it's
yeah.
one of the less strange episodes in the show.
I would say definitely prime yourself before you watch it. I think that's very helpful, but I think it's worth it.
All right, Aaron, anything you'd like to highlight before we go?
Yeah, there's a reason why it's considered one of the best anime series of all time. It's because it is. There are a few things like it, and if you guys. And this is for everyone in the audience. If you want a head trip, Revolutionary Girl Utena. Give it a watch. You'll see.
Yep. No, Aaron's been recommending that one to me for a while now. So I'm adding it to my very, very long list of anime that I got to catch up on.
Yeah.
So, yeah, great. No, this is a lot of fun. So I want to thank you guys for agreeing to go on this little mini special journey with me. This was very important to me that we have this time to discuss the show. Because I have to say, I am grateful that I came to the show as an adult. I feel like my reaction would have been much different. Not that I wouldn't have been able to appreciate it as a younger man or as a teenager. But I was definitely, especially as someone who, you know, has to deal with mental health himself a lot in his life. I'm definitely in a space now where I was much better able to pick up on a lot of the deeper themes of the show. And it's like, it's. you know, I've only seen the show once through, and I've seen the end of Evangelion once, but it is, it's going to stick with me. It's not going anywhere. Yeah. All right. So I think that'll do it. Thank you to all of you out there for listening to this special little adventure in Cinemajoes. Let's do a quick wrap up with where we can find everyone. And then, of course, I would very much recommend that you all check out all of our other regular episodes in the Cinemajoes podcast. So I was your host today. My name is Noah France. And in addition to my work with Cinemajoes, you should check out another podcast that Justin and I did on one of our all-time favorite bands, Genesis, called Pod on the Rooftops. And you can also check out my written material, film reviews, and other media thinkings at francenoir.blogspot.com.
Yeah, and as for me, you can find my work on thecinemaverick.com. I'm also on Letterboxd at thecinemaverick. The podcast that Noah mentioned, Pod on the Rooftops, you can find that on the Pop Break. And just a quick plug for this podcast, Cinema Joes, we are on Twitter. We are on all your podcasting networks where you can find us.
Places.
And yes. And how about you, Aaron? What would you like to plug?
Yeah. So I'm Aaron Harvey. I can be found on not very many places. But at the end of August, the BV Times will be launched, which will be a blog covering all things nerd culture, mostly analyses of either books, anime, film, also role-playing games, video games, just a one-stop shop for all things nerdy and weird. So if you like reading thoughtful and or up your own butt things about nerdy stuff, go to the BV Times.
Much like Neon Genesis Evangelion.
Yeah. Absolutely. There's a reason why I like it.
Good company.
All right.
Takes one to know it. All right.
It does.
Thank you, Aaron. Well, first off, thank you, Aaron, for making Justin watch the show. And thank you, Aaron, for joining us. Aaron, it is always a pleasure to have you here. And you're also, you're the ore reason that this was made possible, because you made Justin watch Neon Genesis Evangelion. And thank, thank you to Justin for indulging my wish for this special episode.
Yeah, thank you, Justin. This was a blast.
Thank you to Alex, who's going to go through all the trouble of editing this, and he's not going to have a fucking clue what we're talking about anything. And thank you to all you out there who listened. My name is Noah France. This has been the Cinemajoes. Take care, and we'll see you next time.
Sure. Do we all get to sing the theme song together?
All right, Alex, make that the outro music. Go.
No, the outro music should be the theme song.